Hey, listeners, before we get to this episode of Problem Solvers, here is a word from our sponsor.
Hello. Do I sound a little different? I probably do because, oh, listen to that. I am not in front of a microphone at my desk like I usually am when I'm recording these podcasts. I am, in fact, in my bed underneath my Bowl and Branch sheets. I love Bowl and Branch because, boy, they are soft. They're a great place, probably not to record a podcast, but certainly to relax and go to bed. They're the softest and most comfortable sheets in the world and the only bedding loved by three U.S. presidents. And for a limited time, you can get their luxury flannel bedding. They will keep cool sleepers warm, but also because they breathe, they can keep warm sleepers cool. And shipping is always free, and you can try them out for 30 nights risk-free. And right now, you can get $50 off your first set of sheets at bowlandbranch.com with the promo code PROBLEM. Get $50 off at bowlandbranch.com, promo code PROBLEM. That is spelled B-O-L-L and branch.com, promo code PROBLEM. Okay, time to stop recording. I'm tucking myself in.
And now, on with the show. From Entrepreneur Media, this is Problem Solvers, a show in which entrepreneurs do what entrepreneurs do best, solve unexpected problems in their business.
We were completely wrong.
And I'm just like, it's not selling.
It was like, we have to start from scratch.
I'm Jason Pfeiffer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine.
I just want to know, like, if you have to be anywhere at any time and how much time you have.
Yeah, I've got an hour.
Oh, okay, great.
1 hour. It's not a lot of time in the grand scheme of things. I mean, who among us hasn't wasted a solid hour just staring at Twitter one day or sitting in traffic? An hour can seem meaningless, but then again, when we're at the office and we work busy jobs and have people demanding our time from beginning to end, an hour can seem impossibly luxurious. An hour is something we just never have. An hour, frankly, is something I almost never have. And that often gives me a little guilt, because here's the thing. I get a lot of emails, as I'm sure many of you do too, from people who are looking for help. Maybe they're students or young professionals seeking advice, or people who want to partner with us or learn from us or pitch us or who knows what else. And I have counseled many young people to go ask for this stuff. I mean, I tell them, you know, one of the best ways to break in is to just go reach out to people doing the work you admire and ask them for coffee or a meeting or something. I do genuinely think that can work. And when I was younger in my career and I had more time, I would say yes to those kinds of requests often. I loved giving someone an hour of my time, and I love when someone gave me an hour of theirs. Many journalists did when I was just starting out, and I am forever grateful to them. But now, I don't really have an hour to give. My day is stretched thin, and so I say no to almost everyone who reaches out and asks me for my time. And that's led me to have this kind of other conversation, this one that's totally contradictory to the advice I give people about reaching out and asking others for coffee. I start to talk to entrepreneurs about the power of saying no and of protecting your time and of thinking like time like a resource. And this is true, just like it's true that you should ask people for their time. But I admit, these pieces of advice don't exactly exist side by side very well. So sometimes I wonder, can I do both of these at once? And how? And I don't have a great answer, but I did start thinking about it recently when I heard from Danielle Creighton. That's who you heard at the top of the episode.
I go to Lafayette College. I'm doing a self-design major in behavioral economics.
And Danielle had reached out to me because she wanted some career advice. She had questions about breaking into new industries and how to prepare for that great challenge and how college really translates into the world and exactly the kind of stuff that people wonder at her stage of life. And she did what you are supposed to do in these situations, which is to say, don't just ask someone generically for their time, but really get to know the work of the person you're reaching out to. So she had sent me a nice note through my personal website and referenced old stories of mine and talked about why she liked my work and then explained her own background and why she thought that hearing from me would be valuable. And so I thought two things when I read this. I thought, okay, one, it's important to say no when people ask for your time, but sometimes it's also valuable to say yes, because doing it even occasionally, even rarely, can have an outsized impact on someone else. And really, isn't that what we're all here to do, to have an impact? And then I thought, number two, I have a podcast. I could record our conversation, and that way my time could scale. My advice to her can be advice to other people just starting out, and that feels well worth the hour. So I responded to Danielle and said, I'd love to talk, but can I record this for my podcast? And she said yes. And so we got on the phone.
So I have 6 questions. It might take like a little bit of time to answer.
Well, hey, that's why we made the time. So this is going to be a little different from other Problem Solvers episodes because it's the first one I'm not doing the interviewing. Danielle is doing the interviewing and I'm doing the answering. We're talking about careers and ambitions and preparation, and I hope that it's either useful to you or useful to someone you know or just inspires you to carve out an hour of your time and give it to someone who could use it. Not always, because I know that's impossible, but sometimes, occasionally, whatever you can do. Because honestly, I don't do this nearly as often as I probably should, but after spending an hour talking with Danielle, I did kind of wish I made more time for it. So, all right, let's get into it. Me answering Danielle's questions coming up after the break. You know how the simplest things are often the most overlooked? I have talked to so many entrepreneurs who ran into problems because they didn't know their numbers. They didn't have a clear picture of their finances, which is, you know, pretty much top priority if you're running a business, but we get busy. Numbers are hard to track. Bad things happen. And that's what NetSuite by Oracle is designed to solve. Serious entrepreneurs and finance teams run on NetSuite by Oracle, the world's number one cloud business system. NetSuite offers a full picture of all your finances, all in one place, in real time, right from your phone or desktop. So that means no more guessing and no worries that you don't know where the problem is. As a result, NetSuite has found that its customers grow 3 times faster than the S&P 500. So ready to check it out? To schedule your free demo right now and receive their free guide on 7 key strategies to grow your profits, go to netsuite.com/problem solvers. Again, set up your free demo and get your free guide today at netsuite.com/problem solvers. netsuite.com/problem solvers. And now, our next sponsor. It's December already, which means holidays and end-of-year fun. But it also means, oh no, there is a whole ton of stuff left to do this year and not a lot of time to do it. And if life insurance is one of those things on your list, well, I have got good news. Policy Genius can help you cross it off. Policy Genius makes finding the right life insurance a breeze. You could save $1,500 or more a year by using Policy Genius to compare life insurance policies. And you'll also save time. In minutes, you can compare quotes from top insurers to find your best price. And then, once you apply, the Policy Genius team will handle all the paperwork and red tape. Also, Policy Genius doesn't just make life insurance easy, they can also help you find the right home insurance and auto insurance or disability insurance. So, if you need life insurance but aren't sure where to start, why not start at policygenius.com? It only takes a few minutes to find the right life insurance policy, apply, and cross another thing off your December to-do list. Policy Genius, when it comes to life insurance, it's nice to get it right. All right, we're back. So Danielle is interested in opportunities in marketing, journalism, and entrepreneurship, which made me a pretty natural person to reach out to. And so I'm mostly just going to run our conversation here. And here's her first question.
How did your major and I guess your minor play a role in what you're doing now? Like, did you picture yourself being where you are now, or were you not sure how you would, where your major would take you?
Yeah. So I have this instinct to dismiss my education, to be honest with you. Like, I don't think of my education as the most important thing that happened to me or that set me up for success, which could just be my own ignorance about how I absorbed things at school. But I just don't track back to my major or my minor or really anything that happened in a classroom. To me, the most important thing that happened to me in college was that I got involved in the student magazine. And that introduced me to a community of like-minded peers who were thinking about this kind of career and the scrappiness that it took. And then I got my hands into a magazine and had to think about what it actually meant to create one. And so, no, I honestly, I saw my English major as just a total burden that I would have preferred not to have to do. And the philosophy minor.
I'm going to break in. I guess I should note here, I was an English major and a philosophy minor.
I enjoyed because it introduced me to this critical way of thinking. And I appreciate the way that philosophers will pick a problem apart and like start down at the very basic level of defining your terms. And I found that to be like a useful skill, a useful way to think. But I actually couldn't really cite anything that I learned at the time. And I don't think that I ever utilized it directly. So no, I really was an experienced learner. And what that taught me was that I needed to do. The most important thing for my career and for the advance of my career was to just do, to just go out and have experiences and then see what I learned from them and what I was good at and what I wasn't good at and what doors it opened for me. So I came to, I'm trying to think back, like, so let me give you an example. Like, so I was this English major, but I didn't really feel like English major prepared me for anything, but I worked at the student magazine. I also interned at a couple of local newspapers. And so when I graduated college, the thing that I thought was, okay, I want to write for the largest publications possible. Like that was just my abstract goal because I didn't really know what it was that I wanted to do. I knew that I liked to write. I knew that I was a bad fiction writer. I was a bad screenwriter. I'd like tried these things, but I was good at journalism. And I knew that because of the internships and the work that I had done on my campus. And so I thought, okay, well, I know how to put myself in front of someone and interview them and get some information, like turn that into a narrative. So what do I have available to me? Well, really the only thing I have available to me is like this tiny newspapers in Massachusetts, which is where I went to college. And so I took a job at one of them, at the Gardner News, and it was like a 6,000 circulation daily newspaper that covered just nothing. Like there was just nothing happening. It was so boring. And after a year of that, I quit and I sat in my bedroom for 9 months and I pitched like larger publications. And the reason that I did that was because I had this realization while I was at the Gardner News, which is that if I want to work at these large publications, then none of them are reading the Gardner News. Like none of them are paying any attention to the work that I do at this job. So I can never wait for them to come to me because they simply will not. I have to go to them. So it seemed more important to get out of this job than it did to stay in the job. And so I sat in my bedroom and I just cold pitched. And I was like, whoever accepts a pitch of mine, I'm going to just kind of become a writer for them. And that's how I ended up doing a whole bunch of work with the Washington Post health section because they became interested in a story of mine and a couple other random places. And what I started to do, and I don't think I was doing it consciously, but now that I look back on it, I can tell you that this was a useful pattern. Was that I would just do things and then I would have raw material that I could shape into something else. So for example, I started writing for the Washington Post health section. And at the time, that was really just because I wanted to prove to myself and to others that I could write at the level of the Washington Post, which was a really important thing. But then many years later, so then I got a job at another community newspaper, and then I got a job at a regional magazine called Boston Magazine. And then I got an introduction to some editors at Men's Health, and they were looking to hire. And this was great because this would have moved me to New York, which would have gotten me closer to my abstract goal of like just sort of working for big places. So I'm sitting down with the editor and executive editor of Men's Health, and they're interviewing me, and they're like, why do you want to work at Men's Health? And the honest answer was, I wanted to work at Men's Health because it was a big magazine in New York. But like that doesn't work. You know, you can't just say that because you have to have a passion for the thing that you're doing. And you want to display that you get it and you have a sensibility that matches the sensibility of the people who are working at the place that you're working at. And so I thought back to my Washington Post health stories and I told them this tale that was totally made up on the spot. But the tale was, well, listen, you know, I work at Boston Magazine and it's a lot of fun and I really enjoy it. But the thing is that I have to spend half of every story trying to convince people to care about the story because there's no necessarily good reason why anybody is reading anything in Boston Magazine. Just because you happen to live in Boston doesn't mean that you're going to be interested in what's going on in this magazine. And so I have to constantly explain to people why it's relevant to them. But I've also done some health writing, and I know that that's not the case with health writing. Health writing is immediately important to people, and they instinctively and intuitively understand why this is valuable to them. And I want to do work that is really valuable for people, and I want to help people. And there is no better way to help people than to write about health, because it is the thing that is truly most core to them. Now, that sounds nice and convincing. That was totally bullshit. I didn't want to write about health. I didn't care about health at all. I just wanted this job. But because I had created this raw material for myself in just doing, I had learned what I was good at. I had learned how to tell my own story. And I just started paving this
path, and it was a totally windy path. And the lesson that I take from it that I will always share in kind of moments like this when I'm talking to somebody at an earlier stage of their career is the most important thing that you can do is to just do, to just go out there and get experience and not think about it in terms of, is this the perfect experience? Is this taking me on the exact path that I want to go? Like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter at the early stage of your career. And frankly, it doesn't even matter at the later stages of your career. What matters is, are you growing and building? And whatever way you can be strategic about it, which at the very beginning is going to be not all that strategic, but in the way that you can be strategic about it, are you thinking about how to get to the next step, even if you do not know what the next step is? So that's a really long way of saying that I honestly, unless you are going to be a doctor and you took a bunch of pre-med classes, at which point there is a direct line from your education to your work experience, your major is not any kind of destiny.
Thank you. Yeah, that's really, I guess, relieving to hear. I know, like I said before, there are a lot of people who don't know what to do with their major. You know, they don't know how to apply it. And I've talked to a lot of alumni who like are doing something completely different from what they majored in. So that's really interesting.
Oh, yeah. Everyone's doing something different from what they majored in. This is like, you are in a falsely constructed world right now, right? Or like a, like, not falsely, but it's like, it's false compared to the rest of the world. Like, you know, there's, you were asked at the beginning of school, or whenever this happens, I can't remember when you have to declare a major. When do you have to declare a major? Freshman year? Sophomore year? When is it?
Semester, sophomore year.
Sophomore year. Okay. So sophomore year, you are asked to declare a major and then commit to what it is that you're going to focus on for the next like 3 years. That doesn't exist in the rest of the world. You will never be asked to do that again. I have, you know, I mean, here I am. I have like a really good gig. It's a prominent job. It enables me to be this kind of public figure. I have never been at a job more than like 3.5 years. I've never worked for roughly as long as you have been committed to your major. I'm constantly changing and like I'm constantly revising what it is that I want to do. And I think that a lot of people have a very similar path to mine. Like you'll just never be asked to make this kind of decision again. And it's not really a functional, healthy decision. You should be able to change constantly. And you will. So like, don't, just because you made this decision like 3 years ago or whenever, I guess, are you a senior or not a senior? What did you say?
Oh, I'm a junior.
You're a junior. Oh, okay. So it wasn't 3 years ago. But anyway, whatever. By the time you graduate, you'll have made it like almost 3 years ago. Like it's just, it's, you'll never be asked to do it again. So don't worry about it.
Okay. Great. Thank you so much. My next question, you kind of answered it. It was about how you got the positions and opportunities you did, like at Fast Company Men's Health. But I guess I will restructure the question.
Sure.
Since I felt you answered it. You were mentioning about kind of like doing things where like you might not be like happy where you are at the moment, but as long as you're growing and building and thinking about like what you want to do next, that's the goal. So yeah, I guess if someone is at like a job and they're not really happy where they are now, would you say like it's okay as long as they're like thinking ahead and just kind of planning and like seeing like where they want to be?
No. So yeah, I should clarify. If you're not happy at a job, you should leave the job. I don't mean happy. What I meant was that the job doesn't have to fulfill some kind of abstract ultimate requirement for you. So, like to go back to Men's Health, I did not care about health writing, just full stop. I didn't care about it. I don't care about it now. I didn't care about it then. But what I cared about was the learning environment. I cared about coming into a national magazine full of professionals who have done the thing that I want to do, and they've been doing it for a long time. And Men's Health is a successful magazine, and more so that, I mean, you know, like this is, I got that job in 2008, so it was like a slightly different environment. Men's Health was a more robust and financially healthy place than it is now. But, you know, it had a high profile, and I was very, very excited to learn from these people and to take on the immense challenge. I mean, they gave me this like 20 something page section to edit every month, and it was a really complicated task. And once I got it down, I saw what other opportunities there were for me at the magazine. I started writing and editing profiles of celebrities, and then actually took on some of the like booking of celebrities and just all this stuff that I thought was going to be useful to me. And it was. And it just, you know, so it's like, it wasn't the subject matter that fueled me, but that was fine because it was such a great learning environment and there was plenty to be satisfied with. So to me, the filter is, or the big question is, are you learning? Like, if you are at a job, are you learning, and are you learning things that are going, that you feel are going to be valuable to you? And if so, then it might still be a good environment for you. And if not, if you're just like unhappy and you're not learning, well, then get the hell out. Don't spend any more time there at all. Go, go, go.
Okay. That makes sense. Okay. Thank you. Also, still talking about this question, do you feel like networking played a big role in like kind of leading you up to where you are now?
Yes. Yes and no. So I was not a strategic networker. In fact, like people who are like really strategic networkers are often insufferable. But a network, just different from networking, a network was really important. You should be so it's like, I'm sorry, I have like 14 different thoughts that are trying to cram their way out of my head at the same time. My father-in-law, my wife's dad, likes to say a life is about addition, not subtraction. And that's a really, it's a great line, and you should apply it to like everything. But one of the ways that you can apply it early is meet people and stay in touch with them and grow with them and support them, because you want people to be invested in you and you want to be invested in other people. So the networks that have mattered most to me were these networks, were like the two groups, a group of people that I met at Boston Magazine, so early in my career, and then a group of people that I met at Men's Health. And at the time, we were all young and equally, however you want to look at it, accomplished or unaccomplished, but we supported each other and we stuck by each other. And in the decade plus that has passed, we have hired each other and we have given each other tons of work and we have turn to each other for advice and for connections. And these are people who I just feel like I'm along the journey with, but I just met them. And if you want to go all the way back to like, so how do you even kind of create the environment in which you're meeting all those people? So when I was a community newspaper reporter and I was desperate to get into magazines, I started going to these meetups that were organized by Media Bistro, which is this kind of, you know, media job listing site. So I'd go to these events, and these events were, of course, all filled with people at my level, right? I mean, like no like truly influential or like big editors or whoever could be there, because there was no reason for them to go. They didn't need this community of kind of younger upstarts. So it was just a bunch of younger upstarts, but I met some people and we stayed in touch, and it was, you know, it was a kind of nice community to have, and people, you know, you want to find people who share your interests and ambitions. And then one day I went to one of these events, and it was like a panel discussion of some sort. And I sat next to this girl named Lissa Harris, and Lissa and I got chatting, and she had just started working at the Weekly Dig, which was this alt weekly in Boston. And so Liz and I stayed in touch. She was interesting, and we got lunch, and I pitched her some stories. And then she invited me to this party where there were going to be a bunch of Dig staffers. And I met Joe Cohane, who was the editor in chief of the Dig. And then I started writing for the Dig, and I started getting to know all of these people. And then Joe left and went to Boston Magazine. And then when I applied for a job at Boston Magazine, Joe helped me get that job. I mean, I like hustled my ass off for it, but he, you know, he was inside and he had the ear of the guy who was going to make the decision. And that was really valuable. And so, I mean, Joe and I have intersected a million times since. I mean, I had hired Joe at Entrepreneur to be my executive editor for a while. He ultimately left for a different job and now a book deal, but like, this is kind of what happens, right? So you meet someone and you stay in touch and you try to grow and you meet the people that they know. And it should feel organic, but it should be like, at the same time that it is organic, you should be mindful that the people that you're meeting could be valuable to you. And so you should treat them not as if they are valuable to you, but just as if you are invested in them and you want them to be invested in you, right? It's like, if you think of it like networking, it sounds like a turnoff, and most people are afraid of networking, or they say they're bad at networking, but don't think of it like networking. Just think of it as meeting people. Like, everybody meets people, and you should meet people and get to know them and stay in touch with them. And whenever you see that they've done something great on social media, like drop them a line and say congratulations. And whenever you have a question that you think that they would be good to answer, you should reach out, and you just start to form these relationships. And then, yes, absolutely. Like, that network has helped me so, so much. I am at Entrepreneur right now because I was at another job and a guy that I worked with at Men's Health was doing some contract work at Entrepreneur and had heard that there was an opportunity here and they were looking for somebody, and he thought that I would be a good fit. And so he made the connection, and that was the intro. That's how I got the job. So, you never know. You just simply never know. So the only thing you can do is like just stay in touch with everybody.
That's great. Thank you. So that connects to one of my other questions. It's about, I guess, networking and like finding internships. So me, like I try really hard to search for internships, but I do that by trying to network with people. Like I reach out to a lot of alumni, as I said before. So yeah, to stand out, I try networking and all of that. But it's not always helpful in taking me to that next step because I don't know, sometimes it just doesn't lead anywhere. I realize it's like not what I want, or they're just, I don't know, just not getting ahead anywhere. So what I wanted to know is, what would you recommend for someone to do when they're very eager and they're going out and like trying really hard to do these things, but they're having a hard time doing so? Like, what would you do next?
I would just, I would keep doing it because like you're going to miss a lot of, the hit rate is low. The hit rate in the world is low. So you shouldn't, like, if you try something five times and it doesn't work, like that doesn't mean that it was a bad idea. It just means that those five times weren't successful. But, you know, you could always step back and think, am I making the right kind of approach? Am I presenting myself in the right way? And what does that even mean, the right way? I mean, like, you know, I don't know. Are you doing the kind of research that you should ahead of time so that by the time that you're sitting down with somebody, they not only understand that you're interested in this world, but that you actually have like value to provide as well. Have you thought through how you tell your story? Have you thought through what kind of legwork you're doing? The most impressive intern outreach that I've ever received myself was from this girl, Madison, who goes to college in Boston. And she had sent me, so we don't really have a lot of interns at Entrepreneur. It's just not a program that we often do. And, you know, it's a really small team here. And sometimes, to be honest with you, this is just the way that the world is going to think of interns. Sometimes what we're afraid of is like you have an intern come in and then they're just like, they actually create more work than they solve because it takes a lot of time to get people up to speed. And if their work isn't on par, then like you've got to edit them a lot. I mean, here or whatever the version of editing is somewhere else. And like it just sometimes internships like take a lot of time away from the people who are working at a company. And so we're really, really hesitant to bring on the wrong intern because it can create more work for us. And we're a tiny team. So what we want is someone who just seems like they can come in and like kick some ass and like do some stuff for us and like bring some value. So anyway, the point is we rarely take these interns. And then I get this email from Madison and it was just a cold email. It was very, very thoughtful. And it had like everything that I would want in a letter like this. It was voicey. She was a good writer. It was well-researched. It displayed a genuine passion and sensibility. And those can be different things. Like you can say you're passionate about something, but then not seem to like have wrapped your head around what it actually means. But to show that you actually can kind of think like this too. Anyway, she was both interested in journalism and entrepreneurship. It was just, the whole thing was great. Like it was just, and she knew the brand. She had done a lot of research. It was very impressive. And yet, what did I do? Because I'm super busy, I just totally forgot to respond to her. So some time went by. And then I, as I occasionally do, go back through my inbox, like looking for things that I might have overlooked. And I was like, oh God, this great email from this kid who wanted to be an intern. And so I wrote her back and I was like, hey, listen, I got to say, this is just a fantastic letter that you did. And I'm really sorry it took me a long time to get back to you. The fact of it is we almost never take on interns. Like we just don't have a robust internship program. And so I don't know that I've got anything for you here, but I just wanted to say like, great letter. And I wish you the best. So what did she do? Well, what she did is that she went to my website and she saw that I have this page, this like speaker page, because I do speaking engagements. And occasionally I remember to update my calendar on that thing. And so I had a listing of some dates that I was going to be doing things. And one of them was in Boston. So she saw that in the coming weeks, I was going to be in her town. And she said, she wrote back, it was a very nice thing. And she was like, hey, I see that you're going to be in Boston giving a talk. If you have any time, I'd love to grab coffee. And so now I felt like, well, I got to. She just did a great job. And what the hell else am I doing in Boston anyway? I'm going to have the time. So sure, let's get coffee. So we sit down and get coffee and we talk for like an hour. I just find her extremely impressive. She's really thoughtful. Again, has done like so much research, seems to really have her head around the kinds of stuff that we do. And I just got this sense that if I brought this person into the office, I think that she actually could just do a great job. And so when we left coffee, I said, let me see what we can do. I'll be in touch. And I immediately emailed somebody on the team here. And I said, get this girl an internship. So then she came on. She was like our summer intern, and she was great. She was just as great as I expected her to be. And so that, like, it's a rare case, but you see what she did. She not only did the research, but she like really did. She just really understood it, and she was persistent but not annoying, and like utilized every moment of my attention. And it was great, and it just worked. So you can always, and you should always, be experimenting. You know, if you do something a couple of times and it doesn't work, instead of just abandoning the thing, you could just think, maybe I should change this, or maybe I'm not doing this well enough, or, you know, or whatever. You know what you could also do, and nobody has ever done this with me, but I think I would be receptive to it. If you meet somebody and you have a good conversation and nothing ever comes of it, you could reach out a couple months later and just be like, hey, listen, it's fine if you don't want to answer this question, but if you do, I would appreciate it, which is, I'm a college kid and I'm looking to get into these industries. And, you know, of course, one of the pieces of advice that I always get is to like network and reach out to whoever, alumni and stuff. And I just thought, what did you think? What did you think of how I reached out to you? And is there like a reason why you never gave me an internship or like just whatever, right? Just be like, can you be brutally honest with me? That's super awkward, but it's actually really great, and you get really good feedback from it. And I still do that. That's a thing that you should do your entire career. Like I remember doing it a lot when I was getting comfortable doing television, which is something I hadn't done a ton of when I was in this job, but now I do a bunch of it. And at first, I wasn't nearly as comfortable with it as I am now. And so sometimes I'd do this segment, and then as soon as the camera was off, I'd turn to the host and be like, how was that? Can you give me some pointers? Like, what did I do well and what did I not do well? And they'll have answers. And they'll be like, yeah, no, you know, I thought it was good. You could have kept your energy level up higher because it kind of drifted off about halfway through. And, you know, you should keep your questions, your answers a little bit shorter, and, you know, whatever. Like, they're all professionals and you're a professional, and there's nothing wrong with asking for feedback. So you could also just ask for feedback and see what people say.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. That's really good to know. I'll try that. I have a few more questions.
Sure.
Which one should I ask next? Okay, I guess regarding qualities that you like about someone, what are qualities that you like best? Like, besides, like you were saying, like showing that they research the company and they, you could see them like going, fitting right in and all of that. But what, is there anything else you would look for in hiring someone, such as motivation, having people that believe in doing the impossible or never giving up or just like working well with others? Like, what other things do you look for if you were looking to hire someone?
Yeah. So a couple things. I mean, one, you should know the world in which you're interviewing to a really detailed extent. You should be able to be fluent in the kinds of things that the people that you're interviewing with are interested in. And I realize that that's not always like completely possible and not every job is going to be like that, but speaking from someone who works in and is hired in an industry that's kind of pretty specialized and a little rarefied, and I think represents the kind of creative space that a lot of people want to work in or whatever the hell. Like, I'll give you an example. When I was at Fast Company, which is another business magazine, we were hiring some entry-level people, and it was a job for a print magazine editor, which are pretty rare jobs these days. And I was talking to these candidates, and I would always ask them, and this seems like such a basic question, I would always ask them, what are your favorite magazine sections? And at first, when I started asking this question, the reason I asked it was just to kind of get a sense of the kind of stuff that they were reading, what they were interested in, and then we could have a conversation about like how that stuff is made and whatever. But what I discovered was that almost none of these candidates had an answer to that question. They would always say like, oh, well, you know, actually, I mean, I kind of just read magazines online, so I don't really, I mean, section, like they didn't know what I was talking about. And if you are not like, and what was I talking about? Like, you know, I was talking about that every magazine is broken up into sections, and anyone who is a real like student of magazines is going to know the names of all of these sections. You're going to know that like the shopping section in the middle of New York Magazine is called Strategist. Like you're going to know these things, and you're going to know the kinds of things that they're doing and some of their recurring concepts because you're reading it, because you love it, because you want to participate in that conversation that's happening. And yet I was finding that these people, they weren't students of it. They weren't thinking about it. They weren't reading it. And if you don't have if you're not able to have a conversation with me about great magazine sections, which is the kind of conversation that people in magazines have, then I just don't know how to bring you into this office and set you up free. You know, like you just can't do it. So it's not just like researching the company. It's like researching and like really knowing the interest set, the professional interest set of the thing, of the people that you're meeting. Also, yeah, I mean, I absolutely want to know that somebody is motivated and like a real self-starter, because I don't have the time or the interest to be micromanaging somebody or to be telling them what to do. I want people to be a constant idea generators. I want them to come up with a million ideas and to show me that if they were just like let loose in this office, that they would create things that aren't here right now. Like I don't want ball carriers. I don't want somebody who it seems like, yeah, you know, they'll be able to come in and I can hand them the ball and they'll carry the ball. That's great. I don't want that. Like, that's not a useful skill to me, because there's a million people who do that. What I want are creators. I want people who are going to come in and just like dream new things up and then somehow make them into existence. Oh, like a while ago when I was telling you about how I really value just doing, one of the reasons to just go do, to just get yourself into situations where you're creating and doing, even if it's just some like random thing, right? Like, it doesn't have to be in some professional setting. If you haven't gotten the internship of your dreams, then can you create something on your own? I bet you can. Something on the web, something, anything, whatever. I mean, we have a million tools at our disposal, and you want to have those things to point to, because in an interview, somebody saying, I am a self-starter, I am very motivated, is not a compelling thing to do. But somebody who says, yeah, well, you know, in my spare time in college, I created this thing and it got a million page views and I got interviewed on radio for it. And you know, now you're like, oh, that's a person who just makes stuff. Like, that's a person who just does. And that's way more impressive to me. Think about it like this. You really want to show, not tell. You're like, you always want to, like, that's good writing, but it's also good interviewing. It's just like show, not tell. So if all you have in an interview is your own word saying that you are a motivated person, this doesn't land. But if you have something that you did that you can point to that just makes somebody be like, what? Like, they made what? Like, that's what you want. That's what you want. Again, it can be anything. I made a Tumblr called Selfies at Funerals that went viral in like 2015 or something like that. It was like one of the most top 10 most viral Tumblrs of 2015, which sounds like it's like the dumbest possible brag. But anyway, like, that thing like paid dividends forever for me. Like, I just could mention that in job interviews and people were like, oh my God, like, what a random, like, you're just making things. You're just like creating things, like, just weird things pop out of your head. And that's the kind of stuff that people are looking for. They're looking for true innovators, even at a micro level.
I see. So I guess, like, for me, would an example be, well, like, some things I'm trying to do this semester, I am organizing like a networking panel for people in the fashion industry. And that was something that I would plan to like talk about in an interview. So is that something like you mean like creating?
Yeah, that's a good start. Totally. Yeah. I mean, a good, you know, like a networking panel for people in the fashion industry is great. Here's one better. Like, what can you, you know, a thing that I've discovered that I didn't really do strategically through the early part of my career, but now I try to do it all the time, is like, if you do one thing, what's the next thing that you can do that builds on top of it? So like, instead of creating the panel for the fashion industry and then being like, but great, like, let's put that in a box and put a bow on it and put it on the shelf. Like, instead, what's the next thing that you can do because you did that? Okay, so now you have hopefully some accomplished people who were sitting on the panel. Can they share some advice with you that you will then put into a newsletter and then start a newsletter for students who are interested in the fashion industry? And then you'll grow that thing. And suddenly you have like 1,000 people who are subscribing to your newsletter. And, you know, you're starting to do more panels and the newsletter is driving people to the panels. And then the people, because there are people showing up to these panels, there are people from the fashion industry who are sitting on the panels. And now you have access to those people. And now they're talking to you. And now you can put that more into the newsletter. And now it grows. You know, you see what I mean? Like, once you've done one thing, you have opened doors for another thing. So don't stop at the one thing. So yeah, the panel's great, but I would push you to think like what comes after the panel.
Have you experienced failure or like received a lot of no's? And if so, what did you do next? Like, were you expected to work harder or did you go in a different direction?
Yeah. I've experienced tons of no's. And what I did was I just kept doing it. I just like kept trying, but I would come back like more accomplished. So when I applied for the job at Boston Magazine, I didn't get it. I was like the wild card. You know, I was the kid at the community newspaper who didn't really have the background that people usually hire to magazines. And so they looked at me and they were like, but he's, you know, I guess I was good in the interview and I could show that I was motivated. I had all this stuff that I had done, but they ultimately hired a guy who had magazine experience. His name was Jeff. He's great. He's at GQ now. And anyway, so I didn't get the job. But when the editor-in-chief called me to tell me that I didn't get the job, he said, listen, one of the things that you were lacking was real magazine experience. I think that what you should do is freelance for magazines for a while. And then maybe the next time there's an opening here, you'll have more of the relevant experience. And I said, great, let's do it. So what did I do? Well, that was around the time where I was networking with those Weekly Dig guys that I told you about earlier. So I started, that was the motivation for doing a ton of writing for the Weekly Dig. Also, I got in touch with Jeff, the guy who got the job that I had applied for. And I was like, I would like to write for you. Here's a million ideas. And then I became his like go-to writer because I was just flooding him with ideas. And so I was in the magazine every month. I was in Boston Magazine every month. And then a full year and change go by. And now, because I at this point have gotten to know, at least by email, if not occasionally in person, a number of the people at Boston Magazine, I was able to know that there was going to be some movement. There was a senior level person who had left. Jeff was going to get promoted, which meant that the job that I had originally applied for was going to be open again. And I just didn't want to leave anything to chance anymore. So I quit my newspaper job, which was in central Massachusetts, and I moved to Boston with a great plan outside of telling Boston Magazine that I wanted to hire them. I wanted me to hire them. I wanted them to hire me. And they gave me some kind of more complex freelance work. And I picked up a couple other freelance things. Like I wrote like a part of a travel book and some other random stuff. And then they gave me the job. They gave me the job because, like, you know, who could possibly have hustled their asses more than me? I mean, like a year ago, I didn't have this experience. And then I became a regular in the magazine and then quit my job and moved to Boston so that I could be like right down the street from the office. So yeah, they hired me. And what's the lesson there? Because I've done versions of that. I mean, that was like the biggest one. I've done versions of that throughout my career. And the answer is like, when you get a no, it's not like a no forever. It's a no based on the circumstances right now, which means that like the timing is wrong or your experience is wrong or just like something's not quite right. But that doesn't mean that it's like no forever. And so the question that you need to then answer is, all right, well, what can I do between now and the next time there's an opportunity to improve my chances? And that means kind of auditing yourself. You know, what skill sets am I lacking? What experience do I need? I mean, it was basically said straight to me in that case. But in other times, you know, you might want to, you know, you may need to step back and say, all right, you know what? I bet that I would be a lot more of an attractive candidate if I knew how to do X or Y. And then just like devote yourself to it and then come back.
Okay. And I have one more question.
Sure.
So if someone has an idea for a business, but they have no idea where to start, what would you recommend they first do? I know you would, from our conversation, you would probably just say to just go do it. And also in one of the podcasts that I heard you did with Bobby Brown, one thing she mentioned was to just do it. So I really like that. Is that what you would say to do? Just go out and do it.
Yeah. Well, so I would, yes, you're right. You've properly studied my philosophy. Yeah, go out and do it, but I'll add something else to it. So go out and do it, but also collect data on it. So you want to be able to know, is the thing that you're doing resonating with people? Do people like it? Are there ways in which you could adjust what you're doing and people would like it more? The point of doing something is not to just like blindly do it. The point of doing something is to test the marketplace and to see if this is an idea that works and if it's an idea that people want. Does it have, you know, what is called in the like business world, product market fit, right? Like you have a product, have you identified the market, the people who you're trying to reach, and is there a fit there? Do you have a solution for somebody's problem? And you won't know that. You just cannot know that unless you do it. So you should just do it, and you don't have to do it perfectly, and you don't have to launch with something that's perfect. Reid Hoffman, the co-founder of LinkedIn, who's got this great podcast called Masters of Scale, you know, one of his lines, which I really love, is if you aren't embarrassed by your first product launch, then you launched too late, by which he means
it's not possible to launch something, to like start something and have it be perfect. So you will be embarrassed by the first thing that you launch. Maybe not the minute you launch it, but right, like if you create something in 5 years, you're going to look back on it, or maybe even in 6 months, you're going to look back on it and say like, oof, boy, I can't believe that's what I went to the world with. But you know what? That was the best that you had at the time. And there was no way to learn and grow and make this thing better without just getting it out there and then collecting data on it. And what does collecting data on it mean? It can mean anything. But as long as you're doing it strategically, it means surveying users if you're providing some sort of service. It means keeping track of sales if you're, you know, I don't know, if you're creating jam and going to a farmer's market. Like what you want to do is not show up at the same farmer's market every single time with the same jam and then just like see what happens. You want to start experimenting and you want to start talking to people and saying like, hey, try this jam. What other kinds of jams do you like? I made the strawberry jam. You think it's good? Oh yeah, yeah, no, but you know what? But I really love pear jam. Okay, let me try some pear jam and then see how it sells and then travel around, like try different places. Is it the farmers, is it a particular farmer's market that sells better than others? Why is that? What kinds of people are showing up? Who is your audience? You start playing with your price. If I drop the price by $1, do sales go up like enough so that I'm making more money even though I just lost revenue? You just want to be constantly experimenting, but you need to be keeping track of it. And once you do that, you will start to see fairly quickly if you have an idea that has some traction. And if it does, then that's really exciting. And if it doesn't, then you want to step back and understand why it doesn't. And even if it is a failure, like by any standards, which is to say you go out there and nobody's buying your jam and you just wasted a bunch of money on strawberries. Like even if that's the case, you will have learned something that if you are so inclined will help you on the next step, because people only, you don't know where the next step is unless you are moving towards it. So if you were out there at the farmer's market and people weren't buying your jam, I guarantee you that you were hearing something that people were saying that they did want. And you could totally pivot into that. And over again, the stories that I hear from people in business are that they tried something, it didn't really work. But in the process of it not working, they came to some insight or they learned something from their consumers or something that helped them create the next thing. And then the next thing was the genuine success, which means that the whole thing was really part of the process of launching and part of the process of success. It's just that it took some time and some changes, and that's a totally natural part of the process.
Yeah, that reminds me of there was an article entrepreneur, I don't remember which one, but it was about like a home like safety installment thing, and like the person was trying to made it for like one market, but then yep. They saw their sales weren't doing well, and then they had to like completely change, like they had to make a decision to like completely change it around, and like they saw it could fit to like another market, and then they made that change, and then they did really well. I don't remember what it was.
Yep, it's called SimpliSafe. Yeah. No, that's absolutely right. I'm glad that stuck in your head. That's a great, great anecdote. Yeah. So SimpliSafe was they created a home alarm system for renters because nobody had been addressing the rental market. So they thought, well, this is perfect. And I think they did some surveys or something, and they found that renters would be interested in this. So they created this thing. It was a wireless network, which was different from what is installed in people's homes, where it's this wired network and it's really complicated to install. And so here was this very simple wireless network system, and they launched it, and growth was very, very slow. And they looked at the data and they found that even though they weren't marketing to homeowners, in fact, they were very explicitly marketing to renters, the homeowner market was interested in this product that wasn't really designed for them or marketed to them, but like half of their buyers were homeowners. And so they realized, oh, wait a second, if we pivoted towards homeowners, we could probably grow substantially larger. Like even though we thought we were for renters, maybe what we actually are is about a different value proposition for homeowners, because people want a very simple to install, more affordable home alarm system. And now they're doing great. And they basically have completely abandoned that rental market. But right, but they would have never, ever known that unless they just started by addressing the renters. Like the renters was the wrong play, but because they did the wrong play, they got to the right play.
Right. So for like a college student who wants to start out a business, I guess you would recommend that they just kind of test it out on like their friends and like just people like they go to class with, something like that.
Yeah, I guess it depends on what it is, but yeah, you have
I mean, you have access to people. You have access to a lot of people. In fact, you have access to the kind of closed system that brands are desperate to be in. I mean, they're like, brands pay a lot of money to try to market on college campuses. And there you are just like sitting on one. So yeah, I mean, you know, listen, depending on what it is, if you have a product or service that you think would be of interest to college students, then you should, sure, ask your friends, but don't rely just upon what your friends have to say, because your friends are not good at this game, because your friends are going to want to be nice to you, or they're going to want to, their response is going to take into account their relationship with you. What you need to do ultimately is just get it in front of strangers and then get their responses. So you should go take it out into the world. And the world could be campus at large, or it could be, you know, the town that your school is in, or it could be, you know, at home during summer break or whatever, or it's online and you're just marketing to everybody because it's not a physical thing. But whatever the case is, yeah, get it in front of people. Get it in front of people.
Yeah, I think that this would be very helpful to a lot of people who are looking to start businesses.
Okay, back to me in real time now. Danielle and I had talked a little bit more after that. She had read some stuff that I had written and wanted to share some thoughts, which was really cool. And so we talked a little bit and we wrapped it up. Anyway, I hope that it was useful to anyone for whom it can be useful, and that if you're on the other side of it, if you're on the side of it like me, receiving a lot of requests for time, that it inspires you to maybe carve out an hour. I think you'll find it satisfying. So thank you once more again to Danielle Creighton for reaching out so thoughtfully and then allowing me to record our conversation for the show. It was greatly appreciated.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, you bet. All right, good to talk. And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to Problem Solvers wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Monday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And hey, be kind. Pass the show along to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost. And did you solve a problem that would be good for this show? Let me know about it. Visit my website, jasonfeifer.com, JasonFeifer.com, where you can find my contact information and all sorts of other valuable info. Problem Solvers is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for all your entrepreneurship needs. And even better, subscribe to our magazine, which is just full of the smartest entrepreneurs solving the toughest problems. My name is Jason Feifer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. Thanks for listening. And hey, let's go solve some problems.